everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the Democratic Party's cognitive dissonance on foreign policy and the myth of American exceptionalism. My guest, Danny Haifong. Danny is a journalist, political analyst, scholar, and social activist. For the last 5 years, he has been a weekly contributor to Black Agenda Report. His articles also appear in Global Research, the American Herald Tribune, Mint Press News, Counterpunch, and elsewhere. Danny's work was featured in former Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney's book about how the U.S. created the S-hole countries. And Danny recently co-authored the book American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. He takes the reader through the history of how the U.S. perceives itself as a force of good in the world despite its long history of expansionism, war, and domestic neglect. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with a couple of essays you've published that look at the underpinnings of foreign policy positions that reinforce U.S. expansionism or imperialism or hegemony within the Democratic Party and some of the candidates running for president. Joe Biden is certainly aware of the issue since, as Obama's vice president, he fully supported our regime changes in the Ukraine, Libya, Honduras, and fomenting chaos in Syria. The bigger picture is to accurately identify the real priorities among Democrats. Is it addressing the threats of climate change and the proliferation of nuclear weapons? Or is the continuation of neoliberal exploitation and colonization on behalf of American corporations in foreign policy their priority? In the case of Elizabeth Warren, although I admire the position she has taken against Wall Street, at least theoretically, and Trump's tax for the wealthy, which is a disaster, on matters of foreign affairs, she is still a conventional Obama-Clinton neo-hawk, and that's my own opinion. The same is true for Kamala Harris and O'Rourke and Cory Booker and others. And unfortunately, more recently, Tulsi Gabbard. I thought she had a lot going for her, and I support her on many of her positions. However, she recently came down fully siding with AIPAC and the Israeli state human rights abuses of Palestinians. So on foreign affairs, it really doesn't matter which party's in office. Both are wedded to the idea of the American imperium. And I'd like for you to address this disconnect between the rhetoric to launch a Green New Deal, which we certainly need, and the threats of climate change and environmental degradation and improving society, but also not giving the public back the power it needs. And all these people, at least promoting the Green New Deal, are looking for the government, not the people, to do it. And we see what a disaster it becomes when the government aligns with private corporations to fix our problems. Just go down any street in Manhattan today going to work. You know, I was looking at 9th Avenue, and it's like 12 years they're working on a stupid stretch of road there that anywhere else it would have taken months, not years. So what are they going to do when it comes to defending the public against the ever-encroaching construct of a rising ocean and the destruction of all of the areas that are now underwater? I don't see anything being done that actually works. And also, even with those who believe in some form of universal health care, Richard Gale and I, our executive producer, we spent a year completely identifying everything in our national health policy that costs money but shouldn't. And we came up with $1.75 trillion that we could save each year if we simply took all unreasonable profits out of the system, which means that it would be very easy to fund it, and all Americans could be covered who wish to be for everything and it wouldn't be a burden upon the taxpayers, we've been led to believe by many people. And also the relief of student debt. I don't know why the Democrats have not asked all the professors, teachers, and students to go on strike until that student debt of about $1.6 trillion is forgiven. But they haven't. And also a livable wage. So on all the important issues, I see nothing that amounts to a qualified change. I see a lot of rhetoric. I don't see any substance. And this is continuing the need of the military to maximize its level as the world's policeman. And all of these people support it, all of them, including Bernie Sanders. The only ones who didn't were third-party candidates who nobody wanted to have elected, Ralph Nader and Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein. They said, as we agree, take about 80% of the military budget and put it back into rebuilding our cities and providing people with work. But both parties agree military gets everything it wants, even when it doesn't need it, and no one's looking at these issues. So take your time, and I'd like for you to look at these positions and see what you make of them and how you can identify the substance of what someone is claiming if they have power versus their own history. What did they do? What did Kamala Harris do when it came to keeping people in prison for drug offenses and that they shouldn't have been in there in the first place and supporting capital punishment, et cetera, versus what they'll say in front of a camera? The forum is yours.
Yes. Well, thank you for that introduction. It really lays out a lot of great points that must be addressed. And so first, I wrote in Black Agenda Report that Kamala Harris right now represents the most dangerous form of American exceptionalism right now, because what she represents is a package of promises, mostly symbolic promises when it comes to having a black woman elected as president, but that package is actually full of dangerous machinations of the U.S. imperial system, which undergirds the entire ideology of American exceptionalism and the symbolism of making the U.S. a more perfect union through inclusion and diversity and those various what I call a form of a con ideology that we can, in fact, improve the internal workings of an unjust state by elevating folks like Kamala Harris, whose record is, outright deplorable. We can first look at how, as a DA, she supported measures to, in California, she supported measures to basically punish truant students and their parents as criminals. A lot of black mothers ended up serving prison time and paying exorbitant fees in the state of California based on truancy, which most, if not all, social scientists, scholars, and activists have acknowledged is a very complex issue and one rooted in racism and poverty and inequality in the United States. We can also look at how she came out time and time again to protect the police when it came to, especially in the state of California and San Francisco, she came out against independent investigations of killer cops, of cops that killed, unarmed, most mainly black victims. And then we can look at how Kamala Harris now, as a candidate for president, has tried to adopt Sanders-like positions on Medicare for All and student loan forgiveness, but then unrolls plans, which are basically for-profit plans, which will only cement the big corporate healthcare industry and the big banks in the lives of people who are sick and people who are trying to get an education. So Kamala Harris's recent Medicare plan calls for a 10-year phase-in period and basically sanctifies the Medicare Advantage for-profit contracted companies of Medicare to basically administer the expansion of Medicare. And supposedly they'll be under the control of the federal Medicare program, but we all know that that is just not how these things work. If you expand the for-profit system, a la the Affordable Care Act, you're going to get for-profit results, which is high costs, and many people will be not only left out, but also those who are taken in to something like that ultimately pay a hefty price just to receive what is a human right, which is health care. And the same goes for her student loan plan, where now she is calling for people who, and she's targeting the Black community, saying Black students who are the most indebted in the United States, that if they are able to start a business and work in disadvantaged communities, i.e. she's speaking about the Black community, if they're able to work in the Black community as business owners and that for 3 years, then they will begin to receive student loan forgiveness. And, you know, this has only shown more so how Kamala Harris is a fraud. I mean, she is someone who represents this image of what the United States is supposedly is, right? A society that's becoming more equal and more fair. But in reality, what she actually represents is she's the enforcer of a more police state-like, a more austerity-ridden regime that dominates in the United States, a capitalist and imperialist regime, which is really all about expanding endless wars, because she doesn't really talk about wars, but she will say that Russia is out to get her. She claims that Colin Kaepernick's protest was actually a product of Russian meddling, more so than it was about racist policing in the United States. And we know that given her positions on things like criminal justice in the past and how she's so quick to change her tune, we know that she will inevitably do that when she is, if she is elected or if she is chosen by the powers that be, the corporate democratic establishment, to run the show. So we know that she will abide by those who seek to profit off of the misery of the masses. And that is really what American exceptionalism is. It's an ideology that is all about ensuring that we can't see this clearly. We can't see this relationship between poor people, working people, oppressed people like the Black community, and the powers that be, which create so many of the problems, all of the problems that exist today. You were talking about the military, and the U.S. military is the biggest polluter in the world. And Elizabeth Warren, her plan is to make the U.S. military more efficient, not in terms of its greenhouse emissions, not to reduce greenhouse emissions, but to make it more efficient in addressing so-called climate change. In her opinion, that's what is necessary, that military readiness and the ability to tackle disasters through military means is the problem, when in fact the U.S. military itself, through all of its activities, all of the military, the 800 military bases that the United States has abroad, all of the destructive wars that the U.S. continues to wage in places like Libya, and the plans that it has for Russia, China, Venezuela, Iran, all these destructive plans which create the need for this gargantuan military apparatus, is killing the planet environmentally, not just the human suffering that it's causing now militarily under the gun that people are facing every day around the world, but the planet is dying because of the U.S. military. But no one in the political establishment of the United States, no matter how far left they are, really challenges that. Bernie Sanders has gotten a little better this time around, but he still won't go up to the point of demanding the 80% military budget cut that the Green Party demands. And it's still too little, really. The military budget needs to be shrinking. It's not even the military budget itself. It's the need to completely transform how the U.S. operates. That's really what the book that I wrote is about. It's about understanding that if we take all these issues together, if we take what's happening in the U.S. electoral system right now, the crisis of legitimacy that is really indicative of why we have a situation where we have 20 Democratic Party candidates out there, and there's only a handful, really, that the establishment wants. Wall Street wants, the Pentagon, CIA, there's only a handful of them that they want, but they can't choose which one yet. This is unprecedented. It really, it is really a new moment where the ruling class is a little unsure about who is fit to manage, because those that they want are losing control of the narrative. Buttigieg's, the Kamala Harris's, the Joe Biden's, they're losing control of the narrative because they refuse to support policies that people on the ground, working people, really want. And we're coming up to a real breaking point where it's either people organize outside of the Democratic Party and begin to form organizations that are about realizing those policies and whatever it takes to get them, or continuing to allow the Democratic Party to work for Wall Street and work for the military-industrial complex, to work for the five individuals who control half of the planet's wealth. You know, as long as that is allowed, there really will be no progressive change in this country, and the elections are a huge indication of that. You know, even Bernie Sanders at this point is having a lot of trouble because he's under significant attack, but his campaign and his movement, because there is a movement behind him, there are people who are behind him who want these things, but until that movement gets out on the streets and begins to demand something bigger than just Bernie Sanders' election, be able to demand that these policies are either going to happen or there's going to be a different party in town, that there's going to be a different political system, political organization in town that will address these pressing issues. Until that happens, we're going to continue to have even more decrepit forms of American exceptionalism. I mean, Kamala Harris is not as convincing as Barack Obama was, and it's only going to get worse because they're losing control of the narrative at the top. But on the bottom, we're still trying to figure out, what do we do from here? And I think one of the first things we need to do is identify those who are lying to us. We need to identify the lies. We need to really point out that Kamala Harris has no interest in serving the people. But she has a long record of serving the corporate elite, of serving Israel, because she's spoken at AIPAC more than once and has showered Israel's oppressive and genocidal and colonial machinations in the Middle East and in Palestine. You know, the same thing goes for Elizabeth Warren, who was a card-carrying Republican for most of her political career, up until she changed her tune and began to rail against Wall Street when it was convenient. But we see how even she will say, yeah, I won't take corporate donations now, but I'll take them later. I'll take them during the general election, because we can't have, I think she called it unilateral disarmament. She uses military language to speak about her own political campaign. And she has a long history. In 2014, for example, she defended Israel's Operation Protective Edge, saying that Israel needs to defend itself from those, you know, savage Palestinians. This is who she is, you know. And we need to begin to see that the Democratic Party, as the engine of American exceptionalism, that in its all of its mythologies, that we are in a situation where the white man's party, the Republican Party, is not. You know, they've been driven off a cliff into Donald Trump's embrace because they've lost the ability to control the narrative. What they do is they openly serve the oligarchs. Well, the Democratic Party now is having a hard time not openly serving the oligarchs. And so we're getting a lot of mixed messages and confusing messages with the hopes that demoralization will win out rather than anger, mass mobilization, and organization.
I appreciate your overview on that, Denny. Thank you. I grew up in a family that had a mixed ideology. My mother was very liberal. My father was partially conservative, meaning he didn't believe you should buy something you couldn't afford. So if we couldn't afford the thing, and we came from a working class, middle class background, but he believed in family values. He believed that we should be there and eat dinner together, and that if you gave your word, honored. If you made a mistake, own it and see what the lesson was. And we would have conversations, because everyone makes mistakes growing up. That is part of life. And instead of condemning when we made some mistake, he would say, what is the lesson in it? I'll never forget one night coming home. I was just a kid. I was like 11 years old, 12 years old. And I found a baseball mitt in the alley. And so I came home and I put it on the counter and we were eating. And Dad said, I see you got a baseball mitt. And I said, yeah. He said, where'd you get it? And I said, I found it in the alley. He said, now think for a moment. No one puts a mitt in an alley. If they're going to throw it away, they throw it away. But in our post-World War II world, post-Depression world, people just arbitrarily throw things away, at least not for my generation. We were a family of hand-me-downs. And he said, now, wouldn't it make sense that someone probably forgot it, and wouldn't it make even more sense for you to go down the alley, knock on each door till you find the person? I think they will appreciate the fact that you had the integrity not to profit off someone else's loss. And I thought about that, and I was embarrassed for a moment because I didn't think of that. I was young. I was stupid. And so I said, yes, you're right. And sure enough, within three doors, I found the owner. And that taught me a lesson, and that lesson was don't profit at someone else's loss. You know, profit only when someone else benefits from that profit. It taught me the benefit of ethical considerations. And so that's what I learned from the conservative view of my father. And on the liberal side, my mother said the role in life is service. And if you ever become successful, and where I came from, no one was ever really successful, share it. It's a gift. And a gift is only a value if other people can benefit from it. Period. Don't make it about you. And again, little lessons in life. So later, when I looked into the politics of other people and what their lives really were, and I didn't want the media telling me about someone. I wanted to see for myself. And the first person I went in depth on were the Clintons when he was Attorney General of Arkansas. And it was massive corruption there. And then when he was selected, he was selected, Winthrop Rockefeller, one of the Rockefeller sons who was a brother of Nelson Rockefeller, he was selected. And he was selected by Fulbright to be a Rhodes Scholar, but he never finished that, got himself into trouble. And he was selected by a woman who was probably one of the five most powerful Democratic women in the United States, Harriman, of former Averill Harriman, the governor of New York, who was in the banking business and the railroad business, a lot of businesses with the most powerful people in America. So they selected you, then they made sure that you had the right image, and then you were elected. So from the get-go, I saw how the Democrats were being controlled by people who you would never see, probably would never know. And what they did is you got to pass. You got to get out of jail free no matter what you did. And we see a litany of crimes by the Clintons and everything forgiven, where someone else, if you and I did the same things, our reputation would be permanently stained and destroyed. And so I began to write about it and talk about it. And then a friend of mine, and this will show you where I'm going with this, a friend of mine and her husband are two of the most powerful Democrats and so-called liberals in America. I mean, they are, if I mentioned his name, everyone in this audience would immediately know it. And we were good friends, and I only knew them never to talk about politics, but always about helping her become a national champion athlete. And that's what we did. We trained and raced. And then one day she was holding a fundraiser for the Clintons. So I sat down with her, and I gave her about a two-hour insight on everything that he had been involved in with the drugs at Mena, Arkansas, and the payoffs, and the women. And she looked at me and she said this. She said, Gary, the people coming to our dinner are about 150 of the most powerful Democrats in New York and hence the United States. They don't care about him or his wife. They only care that whatever they want to do, they will be first in line to get it. If it's an ambassadorship, they'll get it. If it's some private contract with the government, a public-private contract, they'll get it. And so that's all they care about. The morals, the ethics, they don't care about. What they've done to people is irrelevant to them. And I looked at her and I said, you're kidding me. She said, no, I'm sorry, Gary. That's the reality. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I don't want to be there. I'll pass on coming. because I thought there were higher ethics. That's when I decided after he was elected I would stop supporting the Democrats and just support my own liberal views. And that's what I've done and became a progressive all that time ago. So when you look today and you look at the media, you look at the New York Times, Washington Post, the Boston Globe, a Philadelphia Inquirer, you look at the Miami Herald, you look at the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Herald, even the newspaper out in California that Gary Webb used to work for, they have all aligned themselves with the corporate Democrats, irrespective of the scandals, irrespective of their foreign policies. They never have condemned the Clintons and Obama for the massacre in Libya. And I did a whole story about what Gaddafi was like, how good he was to his people, how he represented not a threat to anyone in the world, but a unifying force for the golden era of taking people off of the goal of the American dollar as their means of commodities in Africa. And all these wonderful things he did, creating the most prosperous country out of 54 countries in Africa. Not a word would you know that we did in regime change in Honduras, where all the union leaders, indigenous leaders, were killed under the orders of the CIA and Hillary Clinton and Ukraine. So explain, if you would now, extending your comments to what a person's views are when they run for office versus what they actually do when they have power and the hegemony that they exercise without any concern, any responsibility, or no one ever being held accountable. Bush wasn't held accountable. Cheney wasn't held accountable. Colin Powell was not held accountable. Wolfowitz, who became head of the World Bank, that's how accountable he was. He went from causing the war in Iraq and overseeing it to head of the World Bank. Larry Summers, none of these corporate and government insiders are ever held accountable. They can do anything they want, and they get away with it because somehow the media covers for them. And what does that tell us about the media and true democratic and humanistic principles? Take your time. The forum is yours again.
So just to begin, we write in the book that a lot of this really goes back to the foundations of the United States. And what the foundations of the U.S. government, Washington, the federal government, what it rested upon to begin, and what did the American Revolution, quote-unquote, what did it rest upon? Where we were usually told, that it was a fight for democracy, an anti-colonial struggle, a progressive struggle against the monarchy. All of that really hid the fact that what had happened was that the founding fathers and many of the leading colonialists of the war, people like George Washington, they were mainly slave owners, people who had traded and exploited African slaves. And they were also, many of them, mercenaries in the burgeoning military, which would become the War Department. But they were part of a colonial mercenary army that cleared land from indigenous people and took it from them. That's where the origins of the Second Amendment really come from. The right to bear arms is really all about ensuring that settlers were armed to take land from indigenous people and to protect settlers and especially slave owners and traders from the rebellions, and there were many rebellions of African slaves. And so with that said, the tyranny of the majority that the Founding Fathers always talked about was really a reference to ensuring that the system, the U.S. government, the political system in the United States, would protect the ruling elites from the true interests of the masses. Indebted farmers would be unable to really advocate. They would have no place at the table in Washington. Neither would African slaves. Neither would indigenous people. Everyone who was excluded from the halls of power, and that included women at the time, and they wouldn't have a place at the table, that they would be represented by the ruling elites, and that those elites would, in effect, govern society. And so that was really what the representative republic was all about. And so we come now where the United States has become an imperial system, has become a global economic and military superpower, one that is dictated by the interests of profiteers, and a very few of them now, through the inevitable monopoly that has occurred among the major capitalist enterprises, and they dominance of finance capital, which is very important, especially at this time of endless austerity. What we have is a political system which is very influential over a completely for-profit media system, as you were saying, a corporate media system where 90% of it is owned by just five or six major corporations. We have a situation where the political apparatus and the media are completely aligned in ensuring that the interests of working people in this country, they want Medicare for all, and they want a Green New Deal, they want a living wage, they want student debt, not just forgiveness, but they want student debt to just be gone. But all of these things are not very interesting to those on Wall Street and those in the military-industrial complex and those in the corporate media who serve both of them in order to ensure that their stocks and their profit margins are padded and ultimately enhanced and increased by the behaviors and the actions and the policies of official Washington. So what ended up happening, especially in the Obama administration, of course, Black Agenda Report, we talked so much about how critical the Obama administration was in this period. The Obama administration came at the heels of an economic crisis and a military crisis. So the economic crisis of 2007-2008 had plunged much of the nation into utter poverty, and unemployment was high, and the capitalist economy had crashed and was, you know, in a state of negative growth, which is no growth at all. Big losses were happening for millions of people in the realms of real estate, and everyone's debts were becoming unbearable. And so what ended up happening was the Obama administration came in at the heels of two illegitimate wars and that economic crisis, and it was able to take advantage of the fact that it had campaigned, Barack Obama himself campaigned, not on a progressive agenda. The progressive agenda was stymied. Cynthia McKinney ran in 2007-2008 and was ultimately suppressed. But Barack Obama was able to wait in the heels for Hillary Clinton's first falter in 2008 in order to take the nomination and basically promise Wall Street that he would be the smarter candidate, that he, unlike John McCain, would be able to serve them and also control the social relations and social crises that were happening, the conflict with working people, poor people, especially Black people, who were furious with not only losing half of what little wealth the Black community had, but also the fact that, you know, there were trillions of dollars being wasted on two wars that most people knew now were complete lies. And the draconian surveillance apparatus, which had been erected by the Bush administration to not only stoke the fears of the U.S. being under attack, but also to control the rebellion that a lot of rich people were really scared about and are still scared about to this day. That's what the war on terror was really all about. And so the Obama administration came in and represented the smarter way to govern a class society, and he ended up without any accountability, with a House of Representatives being wholly in the favor of the Democratic Party. The Senate was also in favor of the Democratic Party. They both had majorities in 2009. And what did the Obama administration do? Well, it completely ignored the agenda that was set out for the people, that single-payer health care was completely ignored. The Obama administration kicked out single-payer advocates and representatives and instead opted for a for-profit health care plan. The Employee Free Choice Act, the ability for workers to unionize with an easier path, was completely thrown out. That was kicked out the door. The wars were continued. There was a surge right away in Afghanistan, and the Iraq war was ignored, and actually there was escalations all the way up until the 2011 so-called de-escalation, which really just amounted to special operations forces operating in Iraq and the rest of the region. to the point where now 70% of the world is occupied by U.S. Special Operations Forces who are trained in shoot-to-kill missions and raiding homes and all sorts of other things. The Obama administration protected the torturers, protected the CIA, and ended up increasing the amount of war that the U.S. was involved with all the way up to 8 countries. And then we had the debacle of Libya, the debacle of Syria, and we became ever more closer to a nuclear escalation with Russia and China, that the Obama administration's policy of surrounding militarily Russia on its border, as well as the so-called pivot to Asia, really led the way for what Donald Trump and his administration is doing right now, which is escalating in areas where the Obama administration just didn't have the time to get to. So we're in a situation where the Democratic Party, the party of so-called progressives, the party that says it represents working people, that says it is liberal, that says it has a progressive agenda, that is more and more looking like what it actually is, which is a party for Wall Street, a party for corporate greed, a party for the warmongers, and a party for those who control the United States and ultimately hope to maintain its grip on the world. And one huge thing that is really important right now to consider is the fact that there are two contending systems really struggling for power in the world right now. One is represented by China and its allies in Russia, for example, where they're looking for a more even playing field around the world internationally. They're looking for the scourge of underdevelopment, which was caused by colonialism and now imperialism, to be eradicated from the world. They're looking for peace, while the United States and its allies, Israel, Saudi Arabia, its European allies, are looking to create complete havoc and chaos around the world and in its domestic situation as well, because we know that the United States and its two political parties are really creating the illusion of chaos, and most of that illusion comes from the myth that Russia is somehow meddling in our affairs, and also that the divisions in the United States are just so grand that nothing can really get done. So that illusion of chaos is not only undermining this idea of American exceptionalism, but it's also feeding into the narrative that there is no alternative to U.S. imperialism. There's no alternative to the United States' dominant system of austerity and endless war. And there's no need to hold accountable those who are against what a huge nation like China and Russia, what they want. There's no need to pay attention to the fact that they want peace, that they want prosperity for all, that they're the bad guys. And so we have this situation that points to both the fact that the U.S. is always innocent, yet always under attack, yet exceptional, yet not exceptional enough to ensure that its institutions are legitimate. That's what Russiagate's all about. it's only further eroding the legitimacy of U.S. institutions. But also that China and Russia are forever, eternally our enemies, and we can't even see the good that's coming out of what China and Russia are doing. Not many people know that China actually is one of the biggest investors in green energy, and that actually China has reforested its country, you know, in large percentages, and that there is a whole policy in China that seeks to expand that progress to the rest of the world, the One Belt, One Road initiative. That's a huge policy that's really shaping U.S. military policy. The U.S. is very angry about the thought of China's economy spreading around the world and its influence. So the U.S. is saber-rattling with China, and that's very dangerous. But yet we're told that we should be more so paying attention to China and Russia's meddling in our affairs, and that those affairs are somehow legitimate when, in fact, the United States is not accountable to its own people. It's not accountable to working people here, and it certainly isn't accountable to people in its own backyard, like in Honduras or anywhere else, where it's just causing insufferable conditions, and the conditions that create things like mass migration, which has become a huge subject and a huge issue riddled in the racist demagogy of Trump, as well as the complete bankruptcy of people like Nancy Pelosi and others who have no interest in curbing and understanding why that's happening. They want to keep reaping the profits from the destruction that is waged around the world by the U.S. military-industrial complex. So what needs to happen is we need to begin to think about what is the alternative to the Democratic Party. Because as you said, the Democratic Party works for the rich, it works for Wall Street, it works for the military-industrial complex, it works with the oligarchs. Sanders says it, but he's still in the Democratic Party. And we know what we need to do is figure out how do we sharpen those contradictions? How do we ensure that what happens with his campaign or what happens with any political movement doesn't get swallowed up in that? Because that is really our biggest challenge right now, to be able to move things forward in a way that ultimately aligns with what real working class people really want, just aren't mobilized to get it.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you, Danny. Danny, in the last 40 years, more than 30 million American jobs have been eliminated. Now, they may have gone to work at other positions, possibly in the same industry, but frequently today, 103 million Americans, by the government's own count, who once worked full-time at a living wage, aren't working at all. Instead, they are working part-time or not at all. And so we say we have a 3.7% unemployment rate, and we talk about how good it is that our economy is booming. But when I actually work with Michael Hudson, Professor Michael Hudson, one of the best economists in the world, and he's a humanist economist, he looks at are people working at a job that is fulfilling? Are they able to pay their bills? And the answer is that more than 50% of the American population right now, that's over 155 million Americans could not write you a check for $1,000, nor do they have $500 in extra money in a given week. They're up in debt. Car payments are at high level foreclosure, student debt as well, mortgage debt. And yet the government at no time has stepped in to forgive those debts, to put a moratorium on the debts, to reorganize their debts at a low interest rate. And Obama could have done it, but he instead created, along with Wall Street and the people from Wall Street that control the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, they contributed to the easement of debt and pain on all the major corporations in America. And as a result, quantitative easing, meaning that any company, major company, and politically connected organization that wanted money could get it for free, zero interest, and their bad debt would be washed out by the Federal Reserve, in effect a legal form of money laundering. And yet the average American never once got a home stopped from being foreclosed on. And we pay for all this. And it was ran into the trillions of dollars. The one figure I saw today from Dr. Hudson was $4.7 trillion was done. And yet every student, they could not declare bankruptcy. And Joe Biden was a part of that effort. And people getting out of jail today for just marijuana possession now frequently cannot get a job because they have a record instead of expunging them. And that was thank Clinton's for that. So what the Democrats have historically done over the last 40 years versus what they say are a series of contradictions. And I'll finally put this to it. We filmed a multi-award-winning documentary I did 3 years ago called Poverty Inc. And it took 7 years to film it because everything kept changing from the time of the crash until much of the economy was able at least to be stable. And we went down to Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. And there's long stretches of road, just straight and flat as can be. And on one side of the road, we're talking about for hundreds of miles, there are all these polluting factories. And they're spewing out, you can smell it. Even with the windows up, you can smell the pollution. And yet right across the street are poor people, mainly people of color, lining like a 200-mile area, and you get out and you talk to the people, and they tell you everybody is sick. Cancer is rampant, and nothing, absolutely nothing, was done by any administration to cause those polluting companies to clean up the environment and give people at least healthy air and water and even soil so they could grow things. And so when I said, who are you voting for? They said, well, I've been a lifelong Democrat. I'm voting for Trump. And I said, why? He's an obnoxious person. He has the intellect of a seven-year-old. He is rapacious. He has no redeeming value, and he'd become the most powerful person in the world. And they said, you're right. You know, you're right. But all we have had from the Democrats are promises, smiles, and we give them our vote, and they lie to us. Okay. And that's not a few people that told us that. It's hundreds. Then you go through Camden, New Jersey. We went into the mean streets of Camden, where the police actually stopped me and said, don't go there. You'll get hurt. They'll steal your equipment. I said, no, they won't. Yeah, they will. I said, no, they won't, because I'm there to tell their story, honestly. And when people know that someone is giving them the platform, a voice for the voiceless, they're going to understand. And sure enough, we spent the whole day with gang members and people in the inner cities, and they told us their story. Again, the majority, their family, had been lifelong Democrats. They said, nobody cared about us. Nobody helped us. Nobody got us jobs. Nobody brought back factories as we once had in Camden. And so every city I went to, we had unionists all over Indiana and Illinois who said we were promised, and then they lied to us. And the jobs went to China. And factories of every type went offshore because they weren't willing to pay us a living wage that we had from about 1945 to about 1975. So with the 35 years, the Democrats were strong. Unions represented about 51% of all working Americans. Today, unions are down to 9% from 11% just 3 years ago, and these people are suffering. People are working sometimes two jobs, in some rare cases three jobs, just to make ends meet, and then it's not enough. And yet no one, not a single person, except for the third-party candidates, Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, Ralph Nader, who I voted for, these people, they would have done something. Everyone, Democrat and Republican, make promises to get the Democratic vote, thought it was a shoe-in, and now betrayed them. And now there's a backlash. And they're not taking responsibility that they caused Trump to get elected. It wasn't a bunch of radical or racists out there that Hillary Clinton liked to consider everyone who voted for Trump, 63 million Americans, as some lunatic fringe. A lot of those people are just decent, hardworking people, and the media has projected that they're all, you know, these deplorables, instead of saying, hold on, this was the core base of the Democratic Party for a long time. You betrayed them. Remember what I said my mom taught me? Don't profit at someone else's loss. That means that you're a scavenger. And today, both the Democrats and Republicans represent vulture capitalism at its worst. So could you take a look at this and see what lessons we could have learned if we would have had demonstrations and challenged with legitimate alternative parties, a peace party, you know, a party that would force the military-industrial complex out of power, and yet we don't do anything. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are that there is a critical need to look at, especially the 2016 elections and into the 2020 elections now, because the Democratic Party won't let us forget about what happened in 2016. But their narrative has been that Russia was the one who put Trump into power, and that it actually wasn't. Their own shortcomings, which were so many, and you know, few people talk about how Hillary Clinton got 7% fewer votes from black voters this time around than in the prior election of 2012 because of her shortcomings. There were extensive investigations from people like you, but also other investigations in places like Milwaukee, where many black workers and black community members said this very same thing, that this time around there just was no reason to be excited, so they sat out. And that's so many people, whether they went to vote for Donald Trump or whether they decided to stay home, or whether they just couldn't vote at all for a variety of reasons, really affected the trajectory of the 2016 elections, and Donald Trump is the chickens coming home to roost, so to speak, for the U.S. political system, that the Democratic Party is incapable of providing any measurable improvement or policy for the masses that they say they represent, and that really the system that is undergirding the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party represents, that it ultimately governs over alongside the Republican Party, that system is unable to provide what the working people in the United States and around the world, what they really need. And so, you know, at no other point in history has there been such a need for people to stand up and demand that they either work for the people, that the political system either works for the people or it is scrapped for something else. I know the point has this been more necessary than now, because movements like Occupy Wall Street, like Black Lives Matter, the labor movement, have been unable to muster a strong enough opposition to the U.S. state, to the point where there has been a real confrontation and a real decision that the rulers had to have to make, which is either we pay up or we shut up. And that's really what is necessary now, is that there is organization, that there is a need to understand what the Democratic Party is and how it is a graveyard for social movements, how it is the more effective evil, not a lesser evil, and how everything that happens from now up until the 2020 election is only going to show that reality. It's only going to further expose them. But exposure isn't enough, because we have plenty of people, analysts. There's plenty of that to be had. But really, in order to break through not only the blatant censorship of progressive and independent media, left media like Black Agenda Report and others, are blatantly censored by the Democratic Party elite in their relationships with the Silicon Valley tech giants, ensuring that our content is not viewable to new people, to people who are maybe coming along and saying, wow, I need to figure something out and begin organizing in a different way and begin thinking a different way about the system. They can't find us anymore because of how consolidated the media has become, and then how they're using their consolidated power to ensure that people can't find us. So there's a lot of work to be done around ensuring that our narrative, our narrative is able to replace the narrative that's being lost by the ruling class in their continuing plunge into illegitimacy. And that's going to be super important, because at this time, there's an opportunity here. It's not all bleak, you know, as bad as it seems when it comes to Donald Trump running, for 2020 and, you know, having a huge chance for a second term. However bad that seems, what it shows is that there's an opportunity to begin forging a different path, a true alternative, not just a third party. I think that while third parties, I support them and they're important, we need a party that represents working people, that represents poor people. That's not just about winning an election within a system that is designed to not only exclude you, but to ultimately destroy you and to plunder and to exploit and to ensure that your position in society is one mired in poverty, endless debt, austerity, and and mass incarceration and policing and all of that. We need to begin to think about how do we organize a party that represents us and that begins to build a society that we really want to see, because we need to be powerful enough to confront this, not just numbers, but organization, independent political thought. We need to think about ideology, and that's why we wrote the book about American exceptionalism, because until we cut through that ideology, how can we embrace another? Socialism is great. We can talk about socialism, but if socialism with American characteristics is ultimately not socialism. So we have to understand how socialism in this conversation about a new economy has to break through how the economy is run and governed, how the political system ultimately shapes that economy. And so until we can begin to think about a new political system that is ultimately represented by the people, socialism is going to be really tough to define. It's not just reform, especially reforms that are being utterly opposed by the ruling class. We need to figure out a way to break through that and to organize alternatives to that system.
Danny, thank you very much for being with us. We're out of time. My guest is Danny Haiphong. That's Haiphong. And his new book is American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Very much appreciate you being with us today and sharing your insights, Danny. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hey, hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
More, more.